Hi, I'm Neil Stavem. Thanks for checking out this podcast from Connecting Faith. You can hear the show live each weekday at noon on Faith Radio. And there are many more podcasts for this and all our Faith Radio shows available online. Our web address is myfaithradio.com. And thanks for your gifts to this listener-supported ministry. Enjoy the podcast.
Always expect something good on your lunch hour. Connecting Faith with Life.
Hi, welcome to Connecting Faith. I'm Neil Stavem. I always appreciate the opportunity to get together with you, and we've got a great opportunity just ahead to find out more about a ministry that hopefully we know much about, and it would be wonderful if you're engaged and involved in supporting it in some ways. And we're going to talk today, meet the chief, the very top of the Salvation Army. The Salvation Army is an international ministry now, and we have the opportunity to talk with General Andre Cox, who was elected the 20th general of the Salvation Army just a year or so ago, and he is the world leader of that wonderful organization. General, it is good to have you in studio.
Well, thank you, Neil. It's great to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
I don't know if there's is there just one general in the Salvation Army, or are there many?
As opposed to other denominations, yeah. I mean, there is a time limit on the term of a general. Okay. So there are some retired colleagues around the world who have that rank, but we only have one active general at any one time in office. Yes.
Okay. Well, I wanted to start with, because I know you're British, but wife's side of family is Switzerland, right?
So, yes, that's correct. And in fact, my mother is Swiss as well, so I have roots both in the UK and in Switzerland. But I guess I have more family actually in Switzerland.
Okay. Well, I wanted to start there because obviously, Switzerland, the home of the International Red Cross, and I'm wondering if there are people that maybe don't distinguish the difference. What's the difference between the Red Cross and the Salvation Army? So talk a little bit about that.
Well, certainly. I mean, I think we get involved in many similar activities as the Red Cross, particularly when it comes to responding to disasters around the world. I think the big difference that would set us apart from an organization like the Red Cross is our faith-based because, of course, the Salvation Army was founded in the East End of London in 1865 by a then Methodist minister, William Booth. And so, of course, we have very deep roots in the church, and that is where we come from. And faith is a strong part of who and what we are and what we do. And I guess that would be different. We're not just a humanitarian organization. And I think when people look at the Salvation Army and see us responding in times of disaster would sort of equate us to be something like a humanitarian organization, but we're more than that.
Well, let's expand on that, if you will, because I think there's probably a lot of people saying, well, yeah, that's really what they do. I mean, humanitarian, that's a big job, but what's the more of the Salvation Army?
Well, I think there's a myth that the Salvation Army was founded in the East End of London because William Booth was confronted with grinding poverty. But actually, William Booth was greatly concerned at that time in the East End of London because the church was reserved only for the well-to-do in society. And many of the people who were living in abject poverty in those days were also excluded from the church. And so the founding motivation, if you like, for the Salvation Army was William Booth's burning desire to ensure that these people would also have some sense of eternal destiny. And when he started the work, it was really to proclaim the gospel. It's as a consequence when he realized that preaching the gospel to someone who doesn't have basic necessities or doesn't know where the next meal is coming from is extremely difficult. And I think over time it evolved in his own mind this sort of idea, well, yes, of course there is an eternal destiny that we all look forward to in that sense, but we need to see something of that here on earth. And so some of the practical responses sort of evolved because he was confronted with the realities. And I think that is what makes a big difference with any other humanitarian organization.
You know, it is interesting that the role of I guess, works in the gospel has been debated over over the centuries, and perhaps it was at the time when General Booth was starting, but there certainly is that issue, that sort of tension today, right? Is it works? Is it is it just preaching the gospel? Talk about that tension and the balance.
Well, yeah, I think there is a tension, but I don't think you can separate the two. And I think William Booth came to that realization. It's certainly not because we do many things that we gain some brownie points or something when it comes to our own eternal future. But you can't have faith that just sits back and looks at things in a theoretical area. I mean, faith pushes us really to respond. And, William Booth himself said that it is because of our faith that we want to reach out to those who are hurting, to those who are lost, to those who are suffering. So I think there are many people who find satisfaction in humanitarian activities, but it's not that, I think, that sort of gains us any edge when it comes to our own destiny. It is our faith that confronts us with those realities and pushes us to be concerned for our neighbor. Jesus said, love the Lord your God with all your heart, and love your neighbor as yourself, and it's that I think that's important.
The belief and the behavior.
Yeah, the belief and behavior. It's something that's very dear to my heart because I think it's very easy in our world today if we are a comfortable, living in the comfortable middle class and we're somewhat isolated from the realities of the world to feel pretty good about ourselves. But loving our neighbor means we have to be concerned and we have to suffer when our neighbor suffers.
There doesn't seem to be any shortage of suffering today. Mm-hmm. And maybe it's because we have much more readily access to news reports. Mm-hmm. Obviously, there's a great deal of unrest across much of the world, maybe the Muslim population world. So let's talk about, do you get into maybe the political sides of things to alleviate suffering there, or is it more natural disasters, or is it wherever you have an inroad to go?
I think mainly wherever we have an inroad to go. I know that particularly in the United States, we're pretty specialized in responding to natural disasters on a pretty large scale. And certainly when anything happens within this whole area and going down into places like the Caribbean, the U.S. is a good starting base. And I think that expertise is extremely important. But we don't really limit ourselves to any specific area. For example, of course, just over 12 months ago, this terrible disaster in the Philippines. We've still got teams in the Philippines now responding. We've responded to crises in Pakistan, in India, the recent flooding that's going on there. We're involved in Africa in the moment, trying to help and support particularly countries like Liberia, who are in a catastrophic situation. And I think that is one of the great things about the Army. We are well accepted wherever we go. And while we get into this debate about religions and where Christians are welcome and where they're perhaps less welcome, we've generally felt well received. And we work in places like Pakistan, Indonesia. I've had personal experience of working in communities in some of those countries and sitting down with people of Muslim faith, Hindu faith, and Christians in the community, looking at issues and problems within their own communities, their hopes and their dreams, and what they would like to see. And I think that provides us with some great opportunities as far as that's concerned. So I think open to go where we can, where we're welcome.
It's interesting, just as you were talking about that, I thought, well, I guess maybe sometimes we think, well, this is the Salvation Army is made up of sort of rapid responders where there's this group that can get from place to A to B in a hurry and, you know, boots on the ground ready to go. But I assume that you have within, as you say, within communities that there, whether it's Liberia or wherever it might be, that there are people that are there, or is it, are you all sort of located someplace and just move from place to place?
No, I mean, we're spread across 126 countries worldwide, and so very often the first responders are our people at the grassroots level, some of whom are directly impacted by whatever disaster is taking place. And there have been some moving stories, I think, in the Philippines in particular, where some of our people were affected by the hurricane and lost their goods, but assembled and got themselves organized and started working in communities, and then support coming from outside. And I think that is one of our strengths, the fact that we are present in such a wide area and in so many grassroots communities. And so, yeah, the first responders are the local ones, but then we mobilize and try and bring in support where we can. I think that we are a people with our sleeves rolled up, and we do get involved. We're activists, you know. We get on the ground, and I think that's good. I think we can do more, perhaps should do more, when it comes to looking at trying to help people, prevent people from falling off the cliff. I think in the States at the moment, the Salvation Army is embarking in an interesting project called Pathway of Hope, which really is designed to move people from a precarious living situation and move them to a more secure lifestyle, that you know, secure housing, secure income. And there are one or two interesting stories, I think, that are coming out of that process now. So trying to be a little bit more proactive. So rather than just responding to the immediate need, well, what can we do now to help people perhaps move into a situation where they can be better plan for the future? So and of course, we work wherever we are. We're legally registered in each of the countries, so we often have contacts with governments and political figures. And I think increasingly, particularly in the area of disaster response, we're working very much more in networks. So we won't just go in and say, well, here we can come and we can provide so many hundred thousands of bottles of bottled water when, you know, the place is awash with water, to say. So, you know, networking with other people, where can we fit in? Because I think we recognize, though we have quite a large global footprint, no organization is big enough and no organization can stand on its own, as no government can stand on its own and sort of say, we've got this covered. So there needs to be that sort of openness to work. And so a lot of our work is also forming those strategic partnerships.
We're going to find out more about that. I love that visual. And I think probably those of us that have encountered the people that are working with the Salvation Army, they say, absolutely, it's people with their sleeves rolled up. And we're going to find out more about these wonderful people with their sleeves rolled up, maybe challenge you to become involved in some way and hear more about the great work around the globe, the Salvation Army. We're talking with the world leader of the Salvation Army, General Andre Cox, is in studio today. And we're going to continue our conversation in just a moment here on Connecting Faith. You're listening to Connecting Faith, and we're spending some time today talking about the Salvation Army and the amazing work that they're doing all around the globe. And we're honored today to be talking with the world leader of the Salvation Army, General Andre Cox, who has served as the chief here for the last year or so. And we've been talking about a number of ways in which they're working and the kinds of work they do. And we want to get to talk a little bit about the Pathway of Hope as well. But I want to maybe just go back to talk about some of the crisis spots that you encounter. It seems like they're not all natural disasters. And I'm wondering, can you avoid getting immersed in some of the political issues? Because it seems like many of these disasters, if you will, these crises are man-made.
Well, yes, they are. I think that we tend generally to be totally apolitical. We don't get involved in dealing with certainly not first and foremost as a priority in the political discussions, because I think we feel very strongly that when people are in need, they need someone to respond in the here and now. And I guess that's why we're pretty pragmatic. I think, though, that you will find that probably in – certainly in the developed world, I know it's the case in the UK. I mean, we have people who are working directly and always linked to the parliament in the UK. And I think even here in the States, you will find that, for example, at our national headquarters – there are a lot of opportunities where we can talk with politicians about some of the policies that we see that perhaps have a negative impact. I know less perhaps of the U.S. side of things, but I know that in the U.K., for example, we're pretty active. And when there are issues that come before the parliament and our parliamentarians are voting to liberalize certain things that we feel are creating a danger, then we do become active and speak and interact with them. And generally, we find that politicians want to hear from people of all over society, both the religious and non-religious, on some of these issues.
Are there – certainly here in the States, and obviously you're in the U.K., but in the States it seems like there's a growing effort to, we would maybe say, marginalize faith in public life. So has that affected the work of the Salvation Army, and is it different in some countries more than others?
Well, I think it goes in ebbs and flows. I think that it is true that, of course, mostly governments don't want to – carry any label that might create, I guess, problems in the political sphere for one reason or another. I know that in some places, for example, where there has been government funding, sometimes we've had debates about, well, you know, we like the work that you do, but the message that you bring and the faith element, that's something that we want to tone down. I would say, though, that we're perhaps in a period where our governments are realizing the importance of faith in the life of a nation. But both faith and religion in the world, if you look at some of the fault lines that are drawn, and I think wrongly so, unfortunately, we talk about religion. The Christian faith is about a personal relationship with Jesus Christ, and it's something that we receive, and it really is our own story about how God has touched us. But, of course, it becomes polarized in these discussions about religion. And if you look at the fault lines in the world today, I think our governments are very well aware of the potential for good and for bad when those fault lines sort of clash in the name of religion. So, you know, in some areas, yes, we want to marginalize faith. But on the other hand, I think some of our political masters are realizing just how important and how embedded faith and religion is in the lives of individuals and in communities, and they need to take note of that.
And not to mention the amount of good that you provide that's not on the government expense.
Well, you know, I've spent 23 years in the sub-Saharan Africa, and if you took out all of the faith-based organizations – you would probably take out in some countries between 70, 80, perhaps even 85% of the schools and the medical services that still function. You know, people of faith are often stigmatized and perhaps sort of pushed to the boundaries of society. But you take away faith and the faithful work of people who go with a motivation To share the love of God, yes, but not necessarily. You know, we don't go to someone and say to them, if you want the services of the Salvation Army, here, sign on the dotted line. You got to be part of this organization. We don't ask anything. We respond. And you know, look at the developing world. Take out the faith-based organizations, and those countries will be in a much more difficult situation than they are now. I mean, the army runs schools, it runs hospitals, it runs rural clinics in places where the government facilities have collapsed.
Yeah. Which I guess brings up maybe another question that people might have is how long do you stay? I mean, is it, for example, you said, 20 years in sub-Saharan Africa. Well, that's a long time. It's not just sort of an in and out then. No. The Philippines, yeah. Of course, still a year since that typhoon. So is there a typical sort of time, or is there different divisions maybe that sort of move in and take different
steps? Well, I mean, the Army is – established now in 126 countries, and I mean, in places like Africa, we've been there for almost a century, and so we're there for the long haul. We don't just go in and pull out. Now, when you're talking about an emergency disaster situation, then yes, we will mobilize and we will go in, but we will stay with that situation for as long as it takes. Now, for example, a lot of people have forgotten about the hurricane in the Philippines, but we are still there all this time later, still rebuilding those communities. And we will stay there because we were entrusted actually by the government to look after some of the rural health clinics to try and reestablish some sort of medical service in one particular area. And we'll stay there until those services can recover, but it's not something that is not an activity that we would probably look to be doing for another 100 years. Yeah. We want to get it reestablished, and we hand it back because people have the capacity as well. You know, sometimes we think these people are sitting under trees and they're helpless. Communities are resilient in times of disaster, and really we only go in to come alongside them and to help them along that journey. So the presence in a country is permanent, but when we respond to a disaster, we'll be with the people for the time that it takes.
Well, talk a little bit about that. In a crisis, a disaster situation, natural disaster, and we can use maybe the Philippines as an example, what does a person or a family need most? And is there maybe a universal response that you that is the most important?
This depends, and it's difficult to say that there's a typical response, because in one disaster, the army might be asked, please bring this, bring this particular aspect to support the recovery efforts. But, I mean, the most urgent needs immediately after the disaster are really for secure shelter. Water is always a huge issue, and the danger, of course, of waterborne diseases that come when a community is so devastated, and also basic health care and immediate supplies of food to tie the people over until the local markets can begin to pick up once again, and we've seen that time and time again in Africa.
Well, let's don't mean to interrupt that, because I want to pick that up here in a moment, but we do need to take a break, and we're going to come back and talk more just ahead as we spend some time with General Andre Cox, who is the world leader of the Salvation Army, and we're honored to have him in studio today. You're listening to Connecting Faith. Thanks for listening to Connecting Faith. Our conversation today is focusing on the ministry and the outreach and the great work of the Salvation Army. And we are honored to have in our studios today the world leader of the Salvation Army, oversees this great group of men and women, people with their sleeves rolled up, as he says. They're established in 126 countries, and wherever there's a need, you're going to find them there very soon. And that we've just been talking about some of the typical response, some of the urgent needs. It's shelter and water and health care and food, those kinds of things. But General, we know that the Salvation Army goes beyond just those urgent needs as well. So maybe just talk about kind of what happens maybe after the initial coming into a crisis situation, how it grows and develops.
Well, I think typically when we send teams in, we will send in as quickly as we can get people into the ground, people who have expertise in responding to disasters, who can begin to assess what are the specific needs within that community. And then through our international connections, and I would say that probably the U.S. is one of our strongest examples. I mean, you have a phenomenal capacity here to respond and to mobilize in the short term to get supplies of whatever's needed in the situation. I think in addition to that, our local teams, and that's an element we haven't really talked about, but because very often we're not sort of going into a situation where the Salvation Army is not present. So through the local teams, the whole area of also the pastoral care and the support, I mean, people are traumatized when these sort of things happen to them. And I think the Army is uniquely placed and in most places well-trusted. I mean, when people see someone coming with, you know, the red shield on their clothes or in uniform, and so there is the opportunity also to come alongside. I mean, you're dealing with people facing major trauma, some who've lost family, you know, families that are dispersed trying to reconnect with people. And so these are other ways, I think, that the Army responds. There are a couple of places where, for example, in the Middle East, where we don't have a strong presence, we have been networking with other organizations to try and assist with some of the problems of the Syrian refugees. Now, we don't do that with the aim to go and establish now the Salvation Army in Jordan or some of these other countries. But we do seek out other perhaps faith-based organizations that we can develop a strategic partnership with. And in those situations, we will perhaps support, could be a sister church, it could be another faith-based organization who's there on the ground, who has the expertise. So rather than us going in and trying to understand the situation and the culture, would work through another agency. Yeah. That's happened as well.
Sure. Which I guess brings up, as you talked about, you know, you're well recognized when you come in most situations and welcomed readily. But I'm wondering, you know, people that give to disaster relief, I think we always want to make sure that the agencies are trustworthy. Mm-hmm. And so talk a little bit about, I know that, you know, trustworthiness and credibility, that's something that's been important to you as you've led the Army. Talk about what that looks like at the Salvation Army.
Well, I think for any organization that raises public funds, whether it is faith-based, whether it is just a humanitarian organization, I mean, has to maintain the highest business and ethical standards in ensuring that the funding that is given is applied for the purposes for which it is given. I think that there's an added burden, shall I say, on faith-based organizations, because we shouldn't only meet the highest management and accounting accountability standards of the world, but you know, we have a spiritual responsibility as well, and we call that stewardship. You know, what we have doesn't belong to us. You know, the Salvation Army is a global organization, but it's not ours. God called it into being. It belongs to Him. And yes, I have a responsibility for my term in office, as any of my colleagues have responsibilities wherever they are appointed. But none of us actually own these appointments. They're not ours forevermore. So there is that sort of accountability as well. You know, I think we have to apply the highest standards of the world, but also we have to maintain the biblical standards as well.
It won't be that long before we'll be seeing the red kettles and hearing the bells. And
the weather certainly seems to make us feel that already, doesn't it?
Yes. And I know there are other great drives and events that the Army, Salvation Army, is involved in. So how important is the Red Kettle campaign, for example, to the Salvation Army?
Well, I think it's hugely important. It's not only of course, there's the whole financial aspect. I mean, thousands upon thousands of families receive not only just at Christmas, but, of course, this is our major fundraising drive in the U.S., and certainly an important one. So it's important for those who will receive already over the holiday season some material support and something perhaps to make that time of the year extra special. But it's also a means for us to be able to help and accompany families over a much longer period. You know, people focus on Christmas, and there's a lot of hype around Christmas. And it is a great season, and it's great to be able to share in families. But need goes on the whole of the year, and so I think it's hugely important. The other aspect I think is good is the visibility one. You see the Salvation Army, you know that the Army's there, that the Army's working. People know what, to a large degree, I think, what the Army stands for, and there's a great respect. For example, in Switzerland, in Bern, we don't quite do it the same way they do it in the U.S. here with the ringing of the bells, etc., but we actually have music groups that go around in the town center and either sing or play brass music, which really creates a lovely atmosphere also in the cities. And so much so that the city of Bern in Switzerland have declared that that's a national heritage now in that part, that part of the season. So I guess for us it is also the opportunity to be visible. And when I've had opportunity to participate in that, it's amazing the number of people who actually come up. I still find that now, actually. I travel everywhere in my uniform, and it's amazing how people come up and tell me, well, this is how the Army impacted. Sometimes you go somewhere. And in fact, just last week I was walking in London by the Thames, and there was a man selling a paper, and he said, "Oh, Salvation Army." And told me his story, how the Army, he was helped in some way through one of the Army's ministries in his life. So I think that's important as well. When people see us, they know who we are and the opportunity to engage with them.
Yeah. Were you required to learn how to play the trombone to be a part of the Army or anything
they
like that?
They would never let me anywhere near a trombone. But I did for a time play a brass instrument, okay. But I gracefully retired before I was kicked out, I think.
We're talking today with General Andre Cox, who is is serving as the 20th general of the Salvation Army, the world leader of this international ministry. It's established in 126 countries, and they go where the need is. And we're going to continue our conversation in just a moment because I want to hear a little bit more about General Cox's story and maybe invite him to tell a story or two. And they mentioned something earlier in our conversation, talked about the pathway of hope. And I want to talk about that, too, how the Army is working to not only meet immediate needs and help in disasters and crisis, but to help people maybe get on the right path earlier on. So we'll get to that and more in just a moment here as we continue on Connecting Faith. We're talking today on Connecting Faith with General Andre Cox, who's the world leader of the Salvation Army. He has served with the Army since... Was it the 1970s, I think? Is that right?
I was commissioned as a Salvation Army officer in 1979, yes.
Want to hear more about your story in a moment, but let's talk about, you mentioned a little bit earlier, the pathway of hope. And I know that as I've had opportunity to interact with some of the Salvation Army friends in my community. I'm excited about the work that they're doing to really go on and establish and solve, help address problems as far upstream as possible. Talk about that.
Well, I think there's been a growing realization that, you know, we do a lot of – there's a tremendous lot of activity that goes on in a typical year anywhere where the Salvation Army is present. But I think this focus is beginning to shift, certainly in our own minds, away from the idea, well, we provide so many meals, so many hundreds of thousands of meals a year, or so many hundreds of thousands of beds for homeless people, to more, well, you know, what is the lasting impact that our ministry can have? And I think there's a growing realization that the people who are in a precarious situation often only need someone to come beside them and to give them some support. Sometimes it's some advice, sometimes it's some practical help, sometimes it is some financial support for a time. But to work with the people, you know, it's something I discovered in my younger years working in communities. We sometimes go in with preconceived ideas. Well, actually, look, you know, here's a bit of money and that'll keep you going and you'll be all right. And maybe you'll find your way. But sometimes by sitting, coming alongside people and sitting with them and listening to their hopes and their dreams and the things that they aspire to, we're finding that in conversation with people that there are perhaps ways that people can come alongside and help them and support them so that they won't be coming back next week for the food parcel because we've been able to enable them to find other means, you know, to support themselves. And I think that that is an important process in everything that we do because I think there is the danger also, not only of creating dependency, but also people have perhaps less a sense of self-worth when they depend upon handouts, when really what they need is someone to sit with them and to help them and to journey with them. So rather than simply saying, well, here's a food parcel and, you know, come again when you're next eligible to come for a food parcel, that there's someone actually who will sit with them and talk through the problems, help them sometimes. And we're finding in some instances that it's the little things that enable them to begin to see for themselves that they can do something for themselves. So it's really trying to work more in partnership with people so that rather than a hand down, we give them a hand up. I guess that's the sort of driving philosophy really behind this. And even sort of internationally, we're reflecting a lot more now about, well, what really is the lasting impact? How can we be looking to that rather than saying, well, we need to find 20,000 meals here and, you know, that's basically it. We've done and dusted our job. We feel that it's important to engage with people in the longer term and in the longer journey and building relationships with people.
I imagine it's probably both and, isn't it? You can't just do one at the expense of the other.
No. And I would say this particularly the Pathway for Hope, it is a culture shift in some ways. But, of course, you can't stop the immediacy of, you know, need is still there. And we have to do that. And I think we have to face the reality that not everyone can have, you know, the rainbow ending to the story, but it's to help those who really can help themselves and to make a difference in those lives. I don't think you'll ever find a day when the Salvation Army won't continue doing some of the basic things it does today, but it is right and good that we try and look at a longer-term impact where it is possible.
Soup, soap, and salvation. That's still.
Yep. Yeah. That's still very much part of our DNA. We can't get away from it.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit about your. Tell me about your DNA. That's probably more information I need to know. But I am interested just in your background, how you maybe became involved in the Salvation Army, and maybe what you're most excited about as coming to this place of leadership over this entire operation.
Well, I guess the journey is quite an easy one. I was born into the Salvation Army. My parents were Salvation Army officers. In fact, I was born in what is now the country of Zimbabwe, was Southern Rhodesia, of course, in those days, where my parents were serving. So I grew up in Africa for the first 10 years of my life. And so really I've always been part of the Army. As a child, of course, went to Sunday school, and so I've heard the gospel message, you know, since I was drinking milk from a bottle. I guess it's been part of the journey. We came back to the UK after my grandfather had died. My father was the only surviving son, and so we came back to the UK to be nearer to my grandmother who was living there. And so spent my teenage years, I guess, in England, and still obviously well connected to the Salvation Army. Went to the local Salvation Army church on Sundays. Was involved in the youth activities, but I guess in my teenage years, you know, I'd seen that, knew what it was about, and I had also hopes and dreams. I wanted to see the world. Funnily enough. Wanted to do my own thing. But at a certain point, I realized that I have a Swiss mother, and her native language is French. And I really wanted to – I think when we were very, very small, my mother actually spoke to us in French. But when it came to starting schooling in those days, it was sort of frowned upon. You know, you don't speak two languages. So really we lost that, and I guess somewhere inside of me I had that desire to go back to my family roots in Switzerland, and so went there to learn French originally for a year, but there met my wife and really put my roots down in my mother's homeland, and but at the same time sort of trying to find my own way in the world and do my own thing. But actually, I was confronted in a meeting. We had a Salvation Army officer who had been involved in the closing of the French penal colonies. And I remember being in a meeting one Sunday evening where, you know, he presented the gospel message and the fact that Christ had died for our sins, and it meant all of us. And I realized, yes, it meant me. And I guess that was... certainly in my late teens was a defining moment when I said, yes, that was for me. And I am in need of that salvation. And so I responded to that message. And not long after that, I was going one evening to the cinema with a friend to see, would you believe it, a James Bond movie? I'm a James Bond addict. Quite enjoy a good James Bond movie. And just before we entered the cinema that evening, I had a fleeting vision. I saw myself in the uniform of a Salvation Army officer and preaching the gospel in Africa. And in that fleeting moment, I knew that God was calling me to be a Salvation Army officer, and one day I would serve in Africa. And it's exactly what happened. Some years later, after we were commissioned, we served for a while in two Salvation Army churches in Switzerland. And then we went back to Zimbabwe, and we served with my wife and with our three young daughters for 10 years in that beautiful country. From there, came back to Switzerland. And then, you know, with time, as you get older, you get more responsibility. The then general decided we should be appointed to Finland. And we were made responsible for the Salvation Army operations in Finland and Estonia. And we had 3.5 very happy years in that part of the world, some great, great programs, great involvement. And from there, back to South Africa. And boy, when that call came, we'd thought that for us, Africa was finished. And then the opportunity to go back to South Africa, and we had just over 3 years in a very challenging situation. You know, if there's ever a country where there is pain and injustice and suffering, that is the place. But, you know, Africa's had a lot in, you know, of involvement in shaping me and shaping my thinking. The African idea that I am who I am because of who we are, you know, the whole feeling of, you know, together we can do this, you know, and together we're important. It's been tremendous. And then briefly, we were appointed to lead the Salvation Army operations in the United Kingdom, which is quite a daunting challenge. There's a huge operation there. And from there, I was appointed as the world number two, the chief of the staff of the Salvation Army, and it was from that position I was elected as the general last year. Mm-hmm. And as we go around, I guess, you know, people say, well, it's a tough job, and it is a busy job. And, you know, it's not all the meeting and the greeting and the nice things. It is a huge enterprise, the Worldwide Salvation Army, at the same time. So, you know, there's that reality. But as we travel around and as we have seen stories in New Zealand, we have a thing called Recovery Church there. Some of these big Maori men, if you've never seen the New Zealand haka, that's something you're grateful that the gospel message reached those shores, I can tell you, these big men. But a lot of them involved in drugs and alcohol, and through this recovery church, to hear the testimonies of these people, how their lives have been changed and the positive things that have happened and how they've been able to get themselves established in society because of faith. You know, we talk about the social programs, we talk about this, but the power of the gospel message is still true today. And that is perhaps one of the most amazing things, is seeing lives transformed. We were in Chile, probably in October, November last year. And, we were in a Congress meeting, and, they had on the stage a little boy sitting at the front of the platform. And there was a narration going on about this boy who had been abandoned in front of a Salvation Army institution. And he was just sitting there on the pavement. And someone took him into this home. And because of that, he found shelter. He found schooling. And then on the platform came an older man, and he said, I was that boy. And he was a Salvation Army officer because someone cared and someone took him in. And, you know, it's stories like that that make it worthwhile for me to get up every morning and sometimes very early every morning to do the things I've got to do, because it is changing and impacting lives. And I think that really is exciting. And that has nothing – well, should I say not nothing, because – but – you know, it is the power of the gospel that transforms. And that's part of what we do. But we would never force anyone and say, if you want to receive the material benefits, well, you've got to sit and listen to the message. I think our hope is that in the things that we do, the message shines, you know. Preach the gospel and use words if you need to, I think is really the adage.
Yeah. And that chain of ministry and influence and the chain of grace that's just kind of run through century and century and country and country. It's just amazing.
Yeah. And you know, some people look at that with suspicion, but it's not about religion.
Yeah.
It's about discovering a friend, someone you can rely on. And, you know, we've discovered that for ourselves, and we can only share what is our own personal journey. And people are free to receive that or not, but we will always give a helping hand no matter what.
It's been a great hour. So thankful to have the opportunity to meet and to spend some time with General Andre Cox, who serves at the very top of this massive organization called the Salvation Army, and their international impact continues to grow and influence, and we're so grateful for them. General Cox is the world leader of the Salvation Army, and I guess probably just the salarmy.org, is that a good place to go in terms of a website?
Yep. And that will link you to, I mean, you should be able to get the very local information through that website. And if you want to see the broader picture, you'll be able to access through there the international portals to see what the Army's doing.
Our thoughts and prayers with you and the teams that you lead and all those that are in desperate need of the gospel and the power of the gospel that you provide along with the soup, soap, and salvation.
Yeah.
General, great to visit with you. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
You're listening to Connecting Faith, talking today with, again, with General Andre Cox, world leader of the Salvation Army.